Westchester Talk Radio is broadcasting live.
News, trends, and more.
No one knows Westchester County better than we do.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Good day. Welcome to Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com. I'm John Marino, and we are produced by Shark Creative, made possible by Robeson Oil, the house that service built, Lipolis Electric, don't be left in the dark, get Lipolis, Hightower Westchester, managing your wealth to a fiduciary standard, White Plains Hospital, Michael Labriola, landscape design and construction of Armonk, and by Tompkins, Mayo Pac Bank. The Cup of Joe political show is what? Our show is here, and we are joined by Peter Harkham. Peter Harkham, 40th State Senate District, which covers northern Westchester, pretty much most of Putnam County and a good portion of Dutchess County as well. State Senator Peter Harkham, again, the 40th District. Pete Harkham, I have to point out that you are sitting in a seat that was a Republican-held seat for more than a century, from 1914 until 2018, until you were able to make inroads and turn the seat, finally flip the seat Democratic again. You won re-election last November in 2020. How were you able to succeed where others came up short for more than 100 years?
Well, I think part of it is changing demographics, and part of it is convincing voters that there was a logjam in the Senate, particularly by the Senate Republicans and the IDC. A lot of common sense reforms that were just blocked for over a decade. And it was time to give a Democratic majority a chance. And we have we've succeeded. You know, we have been there for the people of New York, whether it's on taxes, education, healthcare, you know, really investing in the people of New York. And the people are seeing the benefits of that.
You were on the county board in Westchester. You represented northeastern Westchester. Now with this district that you're in the state Senate for more than 2 years now, the 40th, it's a pretty diverse district. You go from all of northern Westchester into much of Putnam County and a good portion of Dutchess County, too. How do you balance what the district needs, knowing that what Somers needs may not be what Pauling needs up in Dutchess County? Or to put it in a different way, from some of the most swankiest areas of Westchester to more open areas the further north you go?
Yeah, that's a good question. And, you know, we also have urban areas. We have Peekskill. And then we have a large immigrant community in Sleepy Hollow, Mount Kisco, Brewster, Peekskill again. I love the diversity, and that's what makes it such an interesting district. We have urban, we have suburban, and we have rural, as you pointed out, in parts of Putnam and Dutchess. And I think it's really, especially in districts that have leaned Republican for many years, you know, as long as they feel comfortable with what you're doing on the fiscal side, you know, property taxes tend to be the number one issue here for a lot of folks, not for everybody, but for a lot of folks. And as long as people sense that you're responsible there and, you know, you're good on veterans issues and other things like that, then they're willing to listen to you and give you a shot on the other issues. And that's what we've tried to do. And we've tried to, you know, invest in the people of the district, whether it's our veterans, whether it's our school children, you know, with record investments, holding taxes down, continuing the middle class tax cuts. As we started a circuit breaker this year in this year's budget for the first time. So we're watching out for middle class taxpayers, but we're also investing, for instance, $1 billion in recovery assistance for small businesses, 800 million of that grant money. So again, it's investing in the people of the district.
Besides taxes, besides schools, besides veterans affairs, what do people in the district talk to you about? What do they say, Senator, we need to get this done?
Well, the environment has always been big in the Hudson Valley, in particular, water quality, drinking water. Many folks are on wells, don't have municipal water, and those that who do are tied to aquifers and local reservoirs. And this is the East of Hudson, New York City reservoir system in this district. And there are some very expensive state mandates that go along with that in terms of keeping those water bodies clean. So back to when I was a county legislator, protecting our fragile drinking water supplies has always been one of my number one priorities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can think back to when I first came to, now I have to say the old WFAS in White Plains. Saturday, June 21st, 1987 was my first day of work there, where they welcomed me into the doors. And the first event I was involved with was a live broadcast with the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater Festival, the annual event going on. Shows you how far back environmental issues go in Westchester and in the Hudson Valley. Even decades before that, too, back into the 60s, people were environmentally aware and conscious about all these issues and topics with the environment. The state legislative session in Albany just wrapped up basically a few days ago. From your standpoint, was this a productive session? If so, why? If not, why not?
Yeah, I think it was a very productive session. And we touched on a couple of the items. You know, if we look at the budget, when we first started the budget process, particularly where we came from last year, and not knowing where we would be in terms of tax receipts and federal assistance, we were able to do some remarkable things in the budget. Record increases in foundation aid with a three-year commitment to get every school district up to 100% of foundation aid in the formula. For the first time, a three-year commitment to begin universal pre-K outside of New York City. We've never had that before. $1 billion invested in small business recovery from the pandemic. And so this budget was really an investment in recovery. You know, when we were going through the height of the pandemic, my office was besieged with hundreds and hundreds of calls of folks who had difficulty getting unemployment through the Department of Labor. We had 9 food drives, we had 3 blood drives, because there were critical needs out there. So as people became vaccinated, we began to open up, we needed to invest in our small businesses so that they could recover, but not on the backs of the middle class. And so we continued the middle class tax cut. And we, as I mentioned before, we started a circuit breaker for the first time, $250 to $300 credit to middle class taxpayers. So that, I think, was very, very beneficial. We passed a lot of bills on the environmental side. In my personal column, we passed a very important bill that would phase out gasoline and diesel-powered automobile sales and leases by 2035. They'd have to be zero emissions. And that's in keeping with our aggressive climate change goals. We also passed a very important wetlands protection bill. That one didn't get passed in the Assembly, but we at least planted the flag in the Senate, and hopefully next year, working with our colleagues, we can get that done. Because wetlands are, you know, nature's water filters, and now we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars recreating stormwater retrofits to catch and clean stormwater because we paved over so many wetlands in the past. So, you know, really by protecting what we have, saves money on the back end. On the substance use disorder side, which I chair the Committee on Alcoholism and Substance Abuse, I co-chair our joint task force on opioids addiction and overdose prevention, some very meaningful bills. One was not mine, but was a top priority, was creating a lockbox for opioid settlement money so that the money that's coming in from the pharmaceutical settlement that's being led by Tish Gaines, that money will be used for treatment and not for filling potholes. That's a very important piece of legislation. We have legislation that would end prior authorization for Medicaid, medication-assisted treatment, which is so critical because we lose people when they're suffering from opioid withdrawal and a doctor has to be on the phone for 3, 4, 5 hours trying to get prior authorization for Medicaid. That's a very, very important bill. We passed it a few years ago and the governor signed it for private insurance, but not yet for Medicaid. So that's a big step forward. We hope that the governor will sign that. That will definitely save lives and save money on hospitalizations and emergency services. So I think, you know, it was a very productive session.
Do people understand in this region, and I've always, when people complain about taxes, they say, John, my taxes went up again. And I say, we live in a region of the country where prices are higher, no doubt about that. And if we want to get the services that we are used to, accustomed to, We have to be willing to pay a little bit more. Do people seem to understand that, especially in light of the pandemic, that to get back to where we were, we might have to foot a little bit more of the tax bill or a little bit more somehow out of our own pockets?
Yeah, and I think part of it is the tax cap, which we passed a few years ago and made permanent, the 2% property tax cap, has taken some of the pressure away from that. But part of it is also the recognition that we have so many layers of government here. People like their local control. We have over 40 police departments in Westchester County. You know, we have 40 court systems. You know, these redundancies we don't have necessarily in some of the other in other states. So it adds to the cost.
You talked about the war on drugs, your work fighting opioids, other issues like gang violence, mental health, gun control. Are we able to see, or are we able to say that out of the last session that just concluded, we made steps towards fixing these problems? We've made inroads towards trying to, after decades of trying to find an answer to these problems, maybe moving in the right direction?
Yeah, I would say first a couple of things. One is moving away from the war on drugs model. You know, criminalizing what's a public health issue has really been a failure in the past. So we need to go to treatment, prevention, recovery, and harm reduction. We're also recognizing the nexus of co-occurring disorders between mental health issues and substance use disorder issues. So we're working very well there. In fact, the Senate passed my legislation, which would merge OMH and OASIS, which is the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, so we can better, through one door, one portal, treat folks with those co-occurring disorders. Again, that's when we have to get through the assembly next year, and we look forward to working with our colleagues over there on it. So we really need to be much more proactive. We have underinvested in behavioral health in New York State, and quite frankly, in the United States for quite some time. In New York, we have, on the gun violence side, we have very strict laws. We've also passed, you know, as of 2 years ago, the red flag bill, the extended background check waiting period. This year, we passed legislation banning ghost guns, you know, the ones that you can make from kits without serial numbers. A lot of the problem that we have now is illegal guns making their way into New York. And if you look at a lot of major cities around the country, and it's not just New York City, we're seeing a spike in gun violence. And the behavioral health folks are drawing a direct line, A, to the COVID pandemic and behavioral health issues around that. And part of it has to do with police were not able to do their investigations during the height of COVID because of the virus, and we were not yet vaccinated at that point. And so we as a country have to do a better job on getting a handle on the supply of firearms in this country. In New York, we're fortunate that. You know, we don't see the kind of mass shootings, knock wood, that we do elsewhere because we've done things like ban assault weapons and we do have strict background checks. But we have a lot more to do as far as stemming the flow of illegal guns coming into our cities from out of state.
Mm-hmm. You bring up a good point there about how guns are coming to this area from states and areas where having a gun is much more legal in many ways than it is in our area, in our region of the country. Do we need something federally finally to come down to make this uniform that maybe a gun that comes here from Alabama or Tennessee where it's legal happens to be illegal in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, somewhere in the middle, the twain needs to meet? I think that would solve a big part of the gun control problem.
You're absolutely right. We need federal legislation, particularly around background checks, particularly around assault weapons. Those are two easy ones. Extreme risk protection orders, as we passed in New York, known as the red flag bill. You know, it's not denying folks their legal right to guns, but if someone may be a threat to themselves or others, a judge may temporarily remove those firearms. But, you know, you look at Texas, my partner's daughter lives in North Carolina, and she said you can walk in, no questions asked, buy a concealed handgun in that state, and walk out without a license or a permit for it. So, you know, states like New York, which are very aggressive, and then you have a lot of states with relatively no regulations. So we do need some national control, I think, if we want to get a handle around this, because, you know, just a thousand and thousands of people who die from mass shootings every year and other gun violence in this country is really a horror, and it's preventable.
And just to point out, surveys around the country, even in states where it's much easier to get a gun, like you said, in a state like North Carolina than it is here in the Northeast, people who reside in those states, are, whether they are gun owners or not, are in favor now of much stricter controls when it comes to being able to buy a gun, who can buy a gun, who should legally be able to have a gun. And at least I think that's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I agree. And again, the point is not to deny lawful firearms owners their Second Amendment rights. We don't want to do that, but there are a lot of things that we can do to prevent firearms from falling into the hands of folks who shouldn't have them.
Mm-hmm. Pete Harkin, State Senator, 40th District, representing Northern Westchester, a good portion of Putnam County, and also a good swath of Dutchess County, too, here on Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com, the Cup of Joe political show. I'm John Marino. Peter Harkin, again, great to have you with us. And let's move over to some more Albany talk. The legal issues facing Governor Cuomo. This has gone on for a number of months now. Whether or not he mishandled nursing homes early on in the COVID crisis, did he engage in some kind of sexual harassment? Did he partake in using state resources in a way that maybe he should not have with regards to his book deal or getting his family tested in the early days of COVID? Number of investigations going on, the state attorney general, Letitia James, other probes going on as well. Where do these probes stand right now, especially considering that we heard at the beginning much of this would be wrapped up within 60 days or so, and we are beyond at that point?
Well, you know, we don't know. You know, and I think on the one hand, that's a good thing because we're not hearing a lot of leaks, which means it's a professionally done, all these investigations are being done professionally. You know, and this kind of also goes back to the budget and the legislative session. With all this whirling around, we were able to put our noses down and get the work done that we needed to get done, you know, and with things like that going on, the work of government needs to get done, and we did get it done. And then when those reports come out, then we may or we may not need to act, depending on what the assembly chooses to do. If they choose to impeach, then that brings the Senate back as the jury. But right now, you know, it's a question of waiting for the federal and the state investigations to wrap up, the ones that you referenced. And in the meantime, you know, we all have work to do.
Some said the governor would be compromised during the just concluded legislative session because all of these legal issues, that he would not be able to execute his end of the deal from the executive mansion standpoint, since we have three branches, obviously, in federal and state government. Do you think he was compromised at all because of any of this?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, he was, I would say, in the budget negotiations, he was very engaged. But I think he was less hard-nosed than he'd been, at least in the prior two budgets that I'd been involved with. You know, I can't say that there's a relationship there. And now, you know, we will see where he is in terms of signing legislation that both houses have passed. So, you know, he was very engaged. His people were very engaged, for instance, in the legalization cannabis. That was a negotiation that had stalled 2 years prior, and this year they got done, and he was very involved in that. And other things, not as much. So, you know, we continue to do our work in the legislature. We'll see what gets signed, what negotiations there on chapter amendments, if there are any per individual pieces of legislation, and we continue to move forward.
Was there anything at all that kind of struck you when you looked at it and said, you know, we were able to get this through, or maybe something somebody else got through? You looked at it and said, this got through this year, maybe because of the governor's situation and he did not press hard enough against it. You talked about the cannabis legalization. For example, some might say, well, if Andrew Cuomo wasn't facing all these legal issues, he would have been tough on stopping cannabis legalization again. Anything at all that you noticed might have slipped through that maybe did not before?
Well, I think, you know, he has always been staunchly opposed to a millionaire's tax. And this year in the budget, in order to fund the education initiatives, for instance, that we felt were so vital to finally get New York moving again, and in some of the systemic inequities in the education system, we raised taxes on some of the wealthiest New Yorkers. And that was something in prior years he had opposed. And this year he acquiesced on. There was some negotiation, but he was not as vociferous in his opposition. Whether that was a condition of his political state or whether he just saw the same fiscal realities that we did in the legislature, that you know, we needed to invest in our kids and our schools in a way that we hadn't before. And in order to do that, we were going to have to tax the wealthiest New Yorkers and not middle-class New Yorkers.
Are you worried, and critics say, well, you can't pass a millionaire's tax or you can't keep jacking taxes up, people will flee the metropolitan region and this tri-state area here. Are you worried about that with the millionaire's tax and with other things that we see proposed?
You know, the millionaire's tax, I'm not, for a couple reasons. One, the studies around the country show that there's generally not a lot of flight from one state to another. If there is, in New York, we have such a dynamic economy that new millionaires and billionaires are created every day in the state of New York. This is where entrepreneurs want to be. This is where they come. So we will continue, I think, to create new pockets of wealth in New York. So, you know, the reason people were fleeing was due to COVID and due to the surge in crime in New York City. Had nothing to do with the tax structure on those earning over $2 million a year.
Stimulus money from the feds. We heard about what New York would get, should get. We hear that maybe it came in a little bit short, and that's one reason why taxes have to be bumped up a bit. Did we get enough from the feds, and did the state partition hand out enough to Westchester and to our region here as the state should have based upon what we need and what this region should get to fund what we need?
Well, it wasn't the state's decision as to who got what. That was a federal decision as to, in fact, they did that on purpose. They didn't want the states divvying it up. So the federal government decided how much each school district would get, how much each municipality would get. Because you remember the first time that money flowed through the state in the early round of stimulus and in the budget over a year ago, the governor backfilled some things because of that money. And the federal government didn't want to see that happen again. You know, it wasn't everything that we needed, but it was certainly, at the time we passed our budget, between that and the revenue enhancers that we did, you know, we were able to fund the things that we needed to do. But what we decided in the legislature is just getting back to where we were was not adequate enough because we were not funding public education at an adequate level. And so school districts like Peekskill and Brewster and others in my district were being severely underfunded. And so we were able to begin to get them some parity moving up. And we have a 3-year commitment to get everybody up to 100% of foundation aid. Because if we want our kids to be able to compete in a world-class economy, they need to have a world-class education. And many of them are not getting that in New York State right now. So just getting back to where we were was not good enough. And that's why we raised additional revenue to make those new investments.
Is there some money for a rainy day right now in the state budget, if need be?
There always is. There always is. And there is a reserve of several billion dollars which is there for emergencies. And when people talk about, for instance, debt in state government, the New York State does not borrow money, although we did some short-term borrowing right at the beginning of COVID. But as a rule, we don't borrow money for operating expenses. So any debt that you see on the balance sheet is for capital improvements, for roads, for bridges, for broadband, those kind of things, for water projects, for sewer projects. So it's much like a home equity loan or a mortgage. So those are targeted investments that will pay a return in the background. It's not like, you know, we're borrowing money to just, you know, keep up the big operation of government. That is done on a day-to-day, year-to-year basis.
Mm-hmm. Some people say to me, John, you know, you talk about things like increasing budgets, and whether it be at a local level, a state level, a federal level, you want to burden our grandkids, my grandkids, your grandkids, with all this debt. And I say, no, this is what we need right now. When it's their turn, they'll figure out what to do. Do budgets sometimes become like monopoly money that you can just up the ante and not really worry too much about it because you have to do what you have to do?
Well, you have to see what the market will bear. You can't out-tax and out-price what people can afford to pay. And that's why we're very careful about property taxpayers and middle class taxpayers, and we're very, very protective of them. But costs of government, just like costs of anything else, go up. You know, there are built-in salary costs that go up based on contracts. Energy, gasoline, and electricity, those costs go up. Materials and supplies, those costs go up.
Like lumber right now, skyrocketing through the roof.
So I think as long as things are measured and reasonable and not for ridiculous things, and you don't go on hiring sprees that are unsustainable, because you remember you've got a back end cost of pensions and benefits, not just with salaries. I think right now we're kind of in New York State in the opposite. You know, we have been on a hiring freeze for so long in New York. You look at agencies like Environmental Conservation in the water unit, that does water protection, I think we could hire more people over there. If you look at OPWDD, the Office of Persons with Developmental Disabilities, you know, you talk to the families in my district who have children or relatives with physical disabilities, they would say that that's an agency that's been underfunded and there aren't enough bodies over there. So, you know, I think we need to look at what is the mission and what is the best way to achieve that mission.
Mm-hmm. Bottom line comes down to, I guess, what the money is for. If it's for a legitimate expense, people say, great. If it's to pad somebody's expense account, well, not so good.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, we don't have expense accounts.
Right. But in general, yeah, you know what I mean.
Yep. Yeah, no, I know what you mean exactly.
Is there anything you feel should have been in this budget or maybe accounted for in this legislative session overall that should have been passed into law that was not or has not been yet?
Well, I think we just touched on it a minute ago, is in the water section over at DEC. You know, the governor in his budget brought on 40 some odd people to DEC to deal with the CLCPA and climate change, which I think is tremendous. Wise move, needed folks. You know, we've set very, very strict climate goals. But we have a water quality crisis in New York State, and we need more folks over there. So either hire another additional or take some of those folks from the energy side, if you want to keep the spending reasonable. I think some of those folks should have been brought over to the water side. Mm-hmm. There were a number of things in the budget that the governor had in there that we concurred with in the Senate that unfortunately our colleagues in the Assembly did not, that had to do with behavioral health, had to do with the merger of OASIS and OMH, had to do with a singular license so that a community center could do both physical health, mental health, and substance use disorder help. That's exactly the kind of thing that we want to be doing so that people can have all their needs taken care of in one place with one stream of billing rather than three streams of billing, which drives people crazy right now. So there were a couple of things that I think we could have done and we should have done. You can't win them all. We'll take a B+. We go back to work next year.
As Peter Harkham looks into his crystal ball about next year, if you had a guess so many months in advance here now, what do you think will get approved or maybe be in next year's budget or become legislation that is not right now but could be right there on the cusp, just needs a little push?
Well, I think part of the discussion that we didn't have this year that we had last year, you remember in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, criminal justice reform was a big deal. And so we passed a number of measures at the state level, became fodder for the campaign. Quite honestly, if you look at them, none of them were that radical. But for the first time, a legislature did something that was viewed as anti-police. I mean, I've had a lot of frank conversations with chiefs and with PBAs. To me, it was more about transparency and accountability. You know, we've got some great cops, but we know there are also some bad actors. So this year, we really didn't do too much on that side. So I think next year, we may revisit that. You'll see some more criminal justice reform. I think there were a couple of bills on the parole side, elder parole, fair and timely parole. There are a whole bunch of things that we thought might have come this year that I guess were not ready to come this year. So, you know, I think as we talk about, social and racial equity, you know, that conversation should not end, whether it's in education, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in housing and zoning. You know, that's something where we are in Westchester, having just come through a federal housing suit. You know, zoning, the zip code of where someone lives defines their access to success in life. So healthcare, employment, transportation, education, all determined by their zip code. And if people don't have flexibility into other housing markets because of the remnants of redlining and those historical barriers, we're still going to have problems. So all of these conversations, I think, are going to continue to move forward into next year and the following years, as we also continue to talk about things like, you know, the CLCPA and climate goals and the environmental issues. And then, of course, locally, now we're on top of the decommissioning of Indian Point.
Hopefully one day we'll have a world where zip code does not matter.
Thank you. Your lips to God's ears.
And I hope that day comes sooner than the way things look right now. I know with the work you do and others do, we'll get there. Pete Harkham, we thank you for joining us here. State Senator Peter Harkham, 40th District, representing Northern Westchester, much of Putnam County, and a good portion of Dutchess County, too. Thank you for joining us on Westchester Talk Radio. Good to talk to you again, and I hope we get to talk again soon. Thank you, Peter Harkham, here, WestchesterTalkRadio.com. Produced by Sharka Creative, I'm John Marino. This is the Cup of Joe political show. Made possible by Robeson Oil, the house that service built, Lipolis Electric. Don't be left in the dark. Get Lipolis. Hightower Westchester, managing your wealth through a fiduciary standard. White Plains Hospital, Michael Labriola Landscape Design and Construction of Armonk, and Tompkins Mayor Pack Bank. Catch all of our Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, and Dutchess, Orange, and Fairfield County talk radio programming on our YouTube channel, Shark Creative YouTube.
You're listening to Westchester Talk Radio,
powered by Shark Media, a division of Shark Creative,
and made possible by Entergy Indian Point Energy Center.
Visit SafeSecureVinyl.com.